Hi, this is Professor Nick Burnett. Welcome to Comm Studies 103 Podcasting. This particular lecture is the Groups 1 lecture. The specific name of the lecture is Small Group Communication and Team Leadership. I'm going to be talking today about some of the features involved in Chapter 8 of your book by Adler and Elmhorst. And before you ultimately do the group special occasions assignment in class, we would want you to read Chapter 8 and listen to both of the two groups lectures, Group 1 and Group 2. And you'd also want to read in Elmhorst and Adler pages 458 to 463 because they're specifically on the kind of speaking that you're going to be doing in the group special occasion assignment. So Chapter 8 and then pages 458 to 463 will help you get ready for the group special occasion assignment along with the two groups lectures. As I said, this lecture is really asking the question of whether or not five heads are better than one when it comes to doing work in organizations, when it comes to coming up with new ideas, solving problems. I think that if you look around the corporate landscape, you'll find that lots and lots of organizations are in fact using teams, as it's called in your book, or groups, in order to solve problems and to provide leadership. And so we're going to look at what are the reasons why large organizations often choose groups to solve problems, and what are some of the pitfalls and foibles, what happens when group communication, small group communication doesn't work out very well, because that can often be the case. So we're going to talk about those issues. As I said, this is part one of two lectures on small group communication. As we begin today also, I want to just remind you that you'll probably have a better experience with this course and with these lectures if you listen to the lectures with the associated PowerPoint slides. Those are available on the same web page as this particular file. So whether you're listening to this as a streaming media or if you're listening to this as a downloaded MP3 file, if you go to the same page, you will find the appropriate PowerPoint slides. Look for the ones called Group 1. Also, I think it's important to consider that you, the way in which you listen to these things, the way in which you kind of work through this process is important as well. I think you need to actually plan on dedicating 75 minutes of your life to listening to these lectures rather than playing this MP3 or playing this particular file while you're making breakfast or while you're playing with your PlayStation. I think you're going to get more out of it if you actually treat it as if you're actually sitting in a lecture. I know some of you actually did play your PlayStations while sitting in my lectures, but nonetheless, give it a try because I think you'll find that it'll work out better. Okay, so let's begin. If you look at the first PowerPoint slides, ask the questions, why work in groups in the first place, right? If you hire good individuals in any kind of situation, why wouldn't you simply assume that they will be able to do the job well? And in fact, individuals can handle many tasks well, but since the 1950s, businesses have been looking ways to improve management and to improve problem solving, and one of the things they've done, after looking at some of the research that was conducted in communication studies departments around the country starting in the 1950s, is they began to move towards groups. And one of the first and most important reasons is they argued that solving problems in groups or working out issues in groups led to increased creativity. And that was very important to a lot of folks in business. They wanted there to be some kind of creative interchange between folks. And so the result was generally kind of felt widely across the industry and throughout academia that if you made decisions in groups, you would see an increase in the creativity of those decisions. And while that matches up quite well with what we know about group communication and kind of our thoughts about all this, it's certainly, I think, the standard, it's the standard line about communication that you, if you work in small groups, you'll get more creative decisions. But what is interesting, I think, is to look at how they came to that finding in the research, because I think once you look at that, you may have some doubts about this notion. If you look at how research was conducted that came to the conclusion that decisions that are arrived at in groups are more creative, I think what you're going to find is something rather astonishing. Because, of course, the key issue in doing that kind of research is how would you operationalize creativity? You can't stick a meter in a decision and say, oh, this is a 5.4, right? There's no easy way to operationalize, that's the kind of experimental design lingo, to operationalize creativity. How do you measure it is really the issue here. Well, interestingly enough, the way they measured it in most of the early research was to simply count the number of ideas that problem-solving groups came up with, and they said that if there were more ideas, it meant more creativity. So it was a rather simple way of counting whether or not something was creative or not was simply by whether or not there were more issues. So, for instance, the standard kind of research would say, okay, we're convening a group of people to work on the problem of solving, parking issues at Sac State. And they would put five people in a room separately and ask them to come up with decisions. And then they would put five other people together working in a room together as a group solving these problems. And what they would generally find is that five people working together would generate more ideas than five people summed together working separately. And so the notion was born, essentially, that there was increased evidence of creativity because the groups came up with more decisions. Or more solutions. Now, I think you can see that the problem with that is that it's not necessarily the case that just because there are more, that it means that those decisions or those solutions or those proposals are more creative. Just because there's more doesn't mean it's creative. And so, while I think that there's some reason to doubt this early research, there was research that was done later in the 1960s in many of these cases that confirmed with more sophisticated ways of tracking creativity that in fact small group decisions are more creative, they are, in the terms of your book, more productive, and the result is that they've caught on in business to a large extent. I think you'll find a high percentage of Fortune 500 companies and in fact even small businesses that make many, many decisions with small groups rather than simply having individuals working together. The second bullet there on your PowerPoint slide talks about another reason to increase, or another reason to work in groups, and that's an increased commitment to implementation. Remember that one of the difficult things of organizational change is not simply coming up with the new proposal, coming up with the solution, but you also have to implement that solution and you have to get people to buy in. You have to get people to sign on. And the notion here is that if the proposal comes out of a small group, then you have a group of people who can work towards the implementation of the policy rather than simply having that policy implemented by a single source, by a single leader. And because it's seen as coming out of a committee that might be broadly representative of your organization as a whole, that this kind of that you have a better chance of implementing this well because of the work in the group. And so if you're looking to maximize the way in which you implement a particular organizational change or a new way of doing things in your business, it may be that giving this over to a group to figure out how to implement is a great way of ensuring the long-term viability of that organizational change. Another important issue for working in groups is to recognize that not all of the smarts in an organization reside in the executive suite. Now, I know it's important. I know that's difficult for some leaders in organizations, in some businesses, to think how could that possibly be true. Certainly the smartest people in the organization must be its leaders. Gee, that's why we're the leaders. But in fact, I think if you look at most organizations, you're going to find that there are pockets of knowledge, that there are pockets of expertise and information that may not even be reaching the executive suite. And that there, in some cases, your lower level employees may be far more knowledgeable about your products. I mean, consider a company that might sell widgets. Okay, we're back to the famous widget factory. And you're not sure why your widgets aren't selling very well out in the marketplace. Well, my guess would be that the people who have the most information on why widgets are not selling well are not the executive vice president in charge of widget manufacturing. It might well be that it's your widget salespeople who are out on the front lines every day competing against the widgets manufactured by other organizations who may have the best information on why your widgets are good or why your widgets are not selling. And that an organization that fails to tap that expertise is going to be a poorer organization. And so one reason to work in groups is to get it outside of the executive suite to bring in ideas from other parts of the company. And in fact, if you just go around here, I think you'll find that there are a number of local businesses. I've heard, for instance, of businesses that work for call centers, right, where there are people who are in customer service, essentially, and they maintain a continuous committee of folks whose purpose it is to perfect the organization's process, to make sure that things are going well, and they don't just ask people who are in the executive suite. They bring in people from across the company to try and manage this continuous improvement, and so they're recognizing the potential for contributions of workers outside the management chain. Two other final reasons to work in groups are maybe less important, but still very critical, and that is that at some level, what groups give you is an opportunity for anonymity. Why is this important? Well, consider a change that needs to be made that's very controversial or that's going to be a very important one for an organization but might actually require a significant reorganization. Maybe it's just something that's politically very dangerous. Think about the way the federal government deals with Social Security. Any politician over the last 40 years that stepped forward to suggest changes in Social Security risks essentially political suicide. It's often been said that that Social Security is the third rail of American politics. You mess with it very carefully, and the result is that there hasn't been a lot of change in the Social Security program, even though those changes are needed. So what do they do when they want to propose changes to Social Security? What they do is they put together a blue ribbon commission, a group where it's not the individuals that are most important in that group. It's the group itself that recommends certain changes. And so they have a blue ribbon commission that suggests certain changes in Social Security. Those changes are then looked at and talked about and discussed, and they don't have to be from any particular senator, from any particular congressman. Ultimately, those people on the commission are the ones that kind of put it on the line. But you don't have as much recognition as being individually responsible for a decision. So sometimes opportunities for anonymity are important in getting organizational change, especially difficult organizational change, passed. A final benefit, as you see there on your list, is the relational benefits of working in groups. Let me give you a personal example here. In addition to doing my work at the department level and working in my College of Arts and Letters, I also am on university committees where I work with representatives from folks from across the campus. For instance, I'm on the professional leave committee, and what we do is we evaluate the proposals from faculty members who are going to go on sabbatical. I would never have met a number of people who are, I now consider both friends and colleagues from across the university, had I not been on that committee. And the university knows that it's a good thing to keep people in various departments and in various colleges connected with one another, because if we get to a point where we're pitting one college against another, you get to a very difficult political space, really, in the university. And it's important that we each understand each other's problems, so that people in arts and letters understand the problems of the people in the College of Business, that we all understand the problems of the people in the College of Education, and so on. Using committees where we have to have representatives from each of the various colleges brings faculty members into contact with folks that we might normally have had contact with. And the result is there are relational benefits. There are relationships established as a result of serving on these committees. So, for instance, you may have taken a course from Professor LaRocca over in the business school. I worked with him on a university committee, and I might never have had that relationship. I might never have had that point of contact had I not been on that committee. Businesses understand this as well, and they understand that the most important way to broaden people's perspectives, to get them to understand the problems of other areas within a particular organization, is to get them to work together in a group situation so that you build up those relationships point by point, so that you give people a chance to work with each other and see the perspective of other people. So those are the reasons why we might want to consider working with groups. But of course, groups are not the solution to every problem. And one of the most obvious points at which groups get into trouble is we think that, well, if a little bit of small group communication is a good thing, then maybe more small group communication will be really good. And the result is they try and pack more and more people and more folks representing different interests onto small groups. And all of a sudden, what started as a small group of 5 or 7 or even 9 people soon becomes 12 or 15 or 20. And as your book notes, when you start to get upwards of 15 or 20 people, you start to lose some of the advantages that you had to working in small groups in the first place. So I thought we would talk very briefly about what happens when a group gets too large and a reason to keep small groups smaller. And there are some really powerful negatives that may emerge. One of the first is that when you've got a small group that gets too big, when their focus gets off the main group goal, you have the formation of subgroups or cliques. And these are smaller factions within a small group that has grown too large. And what happens is that the people's loyalty and the people's attention turns to advancing the purposes and goals of these small groups rather than the purposes and goals of the larger small group as a whole. And when you have these cliques and small group formations forming, you can divert attention and you can divert energy from the prime goal rather than these kind of smaller agendas that pop up when groups get too large. Of course, you also have the problem of when there is a larger group and you have only a certain amount of time to meet, the actual amount of time that any individual member of that group gets to speak is likely to be far less. It also means that the chances for unequal participation go up. I mean, if you think about it, if you have 45 minutes for a small group meeting and there are only 5 of you, then over the course of that small meeting, you might expect that each person gets to talk for about 9 minutes. But suppose now instead of 5 people on the committee, there are 15 people on the committee. You have 45 minutes to meet, and that might mean your average chance for talking might reduce to only 3 minutes out of that 45 minutes. You may seem to feel that that's not worth as much participation in time. As a result, you withdraw, and then you get our next bullet, which is an increased likelihood of domination by other members. As groups get larger, more people withdraw, other people tend to dominate. You've probably had this experience, haven't you, in a class where you have, isn't there always like 1 or 2 students who just loves to hear the sound of themselves talking? And the result is that this student begins to dominate and other people go, oh boy, here they go again, and they start to withdraw. And a faculty member that does not understand the dynamic that's taking place runs the risk of having 1 or 2 people dominate an entire class. And that's not the situation that you want to have if you're trying to have good interaction, if you're trying to have equal participation from the various members of the class. And at that point, it's really up to the instructor to step in, talk to that student, and say, look, I'd like you to dial it back a little bit. I understand that you have some contributions to make, but there are other people who need to have contributions as well. So I'd appreciate it if you stepped back a little bit. Not all faculty members are willing to do that, but particularly when you're working in small groups, the leader of the group may have to take the initiative to ask a particularly involved member, somebody who seems to be dominating the conversation, to step back a little bit in order for other members of the group to shine. Another issue that happens when small groups get very large is that it increases the demands on leaders. It's tough to be the person who's the leader of the group. It's even tougher when your job gets more difficult because the number of people that you have to accommodate at the meeting, the number of people's schedules you have to take into account when you're trying to schedule these meetings, gets far more difficult. And the problem, of course, is that if groups get too big and the demands on leaders get too high, you're likely to have very talented people who could play an important role of leaders of the group stepping back and saying, no, I don't want to be involved in leadership. And that means that you're not getting the best people as leaders of your group, and the result, it might be that your productivity suffers. The fifth bullet on your PowerPoint slide talks about the need for higher tolerance of group takeover of administrative tasks. Whereas it used to be accomplished kind of informally within the group, all of a sudden you have to make special accommodations for who's going to do the scheduling or who's going to be the person to be the secretary for the group, who's going to take notes on exactly what's happening. This can be a real problem because as administration begins to kind of take over some of the group functions, the individual group members feel less involved in what's going on. And I would argue, finally, that the most important problem when you have a very large group is that you're going to have difficulty achieving what is the most important kind of small group decision-making, and that is consensus. A consensus, as we'll talk about later on, is when group members are able to talk out their differences and all come to a solution that they can all sign on to. Ultimately, the more people you add to a group, the more difficulty you're going to have in coming to that consensus. And I think you want to be aware of that as you're kind of pressing forward and trying to add more people to the group, because you may be giving up a particular kind of decision-making that's important and unique. Beyond the problem of just general small groups getting too large, there are some other potential disadvantages to group decision-making and using teams and businesses that I want to point out. Your book uses this term, the first new bullet on your third page now, possible disadvantages to groups. It's called social loafing. Oh, come on, you've seen this before when you've been involved in working in groups in various classes where, you know, there's five people in your group and it always seems that there's one knucklehead who's simply willing to kind of float along with whatever the group is doing, doing the minimum, but then certainly being willing to step up in the end and taking advantage of the good grade that you all have worked hard to get. One of the disadvantages to groups is that if you don't have good leaders who are trying to get everybody to participate equally and everybody to be involved, is that you create this potential for social loafing, where folks are not in fact working. And then it's a disadvantage for the group, because if you've got two groups competing against each other and they each have four people on them, you take away one of those people in one of those groups, and it automatically means that the workload on the remaining three folks who are doing the work and who are working hard is going to be increased. And that's a disadvantage because it kind of can lead to burnout, and you're not going to get as high a work product. I mean, there's a reason why you have all those folks in the group to begin with. Another possible disadvantage, as I've already mentioned, is that you have the possibility where one person may dominate the discussion. And when people start to dominate groups, that means that the other folks are being less satisfied by their participation in that group. They don't get a chance to express their views. That one member is seen to be dominating things, and the result is you do not have the kind of productivity increases that you expect. The flip side of domination is the situation where if you end up in a group where you have a lot of people who are not very interested in working hard, if you have more than one, say, social loafer, you get the high achievers who are committed to doing well in whatever the group project is. And again, this might be something that you've experienced in a class. And you get the folks who just say, oh, fine, I'd just rather do it myself. And so you have these kind of martyrs who take on the role of the entire group process for themselves, because they don't want to be at the mercy of the people who are not working hard. They still want to preserve their grade in the class, for instance. And the result is you get people who are kind of withdrawn. You have this one super person who's trying to do it all. They get burnt out. Their work product is not going to be as good as if it had the benefit of ultimately working with the other people in the group. And it can be a sorry situation. So you have to be on guard against, you know, people taking on this mantle of leadership where they try and do all of the group work by themselves. The fourth bullet on your slide there talks about the pressure to conform. And this is actually an area of research that's of critical interest to lots of different folks, because the idea was always brought up, what happens when you have people working in a small group and they come to be dominated by other members of the group? Will they stick up for what they believe in? Will they stick to their guns? Will they defend their interests? Or will they simply roll over? And there has been some very interesting research that's been done, for instance, in the area of jury verdicts. Doesn't that make sense that, you know, if you were a defense attorney, you would want to know whether or not the people that you ultimately approve of being on a particular jury are going to be willing to stick up for the innocence of your defendant rather than simply rolling over and saying, oh, you're right, it's almost lunchtime, they're guilty, let's go to lunch. That is an extremely important area of research. One area in particular, one researcher in particular is a fellow by the name of Solomon Asch, that's A-S-C-H, and he was able to demonstrate with some research that was done both for the Department of the Army and then outside of the Army, that there are times when people can be so dominated in a group that they would be willing that it became more important for them to conform to whatever the group said rather than to defend what even is something that's obvious and verifiable. Now, in something where it's subjective, like, what do you think we should do? What's the best movie? And we talk in a group about what's the best movie. That's a subjective issue. And whether you think it's The Godfather or Top Gun or, whatever your favorite film is, you might be willing in a group situation so as to not make waves and to kind of get along with the other people in the group to kind of go along with whatever the group's choice is. And that makes sense as long as it's something that's subjective. But what about if it's something that's objective? And this is where Solomon Asch really had some very interesting research. He put 10 people in a room. 9 of the people were working for Asch, and only one was really the experimental subject. And he showed this group of people 2 lines, line A and line B, just lines marked on a piece of paper. And he asked them to go around their group and tell the researcher which line was longer. Now, if you put a tape measure or a ruler to these lines, it was obvious that B was longer than A. But what Asch set up was a situation where the other members of the group would say that A, in fact, was the longer line, and that B was, in fact, shorter. Now, this was not the case, but this is what these people were going to say. And he manipulated the setup of the room so that all of the other people who were, in fact, people working with Asch would say that A is the longer line until it all the way got around the room to the experimental subject. And then the experimental subject had to say out loud whether they thought B, which really was longer, was the longest line, or A, which is what everybody else had picked as the longest line. And in a troubling number of circumstances, really a very high percentage, people, even in the case where you could objectively measure the length of the lines, would say that A was longer simply because the other members of the group had said that A was longer. That kind of research is very troubling because it means that people are sometimes not willing to stand up for their point of view. I don't know whether or not culturally that would still be the case, whether or not we still have a situation where people would be unwilling to stand up and defend their point of view. But ultimately, this pressure to conform is something that you want to be aware of when you're dealing with small groups. A final possible disadvantage to groups, and I want to say this very carefully, is called risky shift. Risky shift. The risky shift phenomenon posits this notion that groups will tend to make decisions that are riskier than individuals making the same kind of decision. That is, groups will seek out solutions to problems or propose solutions that have more risk for an organization than if an individual was making that decision by themselves. And so they've done research, for instance, where they've given both individuals and groups the same kind of problem, and groups would consistently come up with solutions that were riskier. Now, here's the real problem. Let's say you're the CEO of a company, and you assign a small group to do a task, to come up with a solution to a problem that you're having in that organization. If those folks come up with a solution that is too risky for your taste, if you think that you don't want to risk organizational resources or capital in a particular way that this group has suggested that you do, you may have to come back and tell that group, thank you for your time. We appreciate your service. I understand the time and effort that went into your proposal of this particular solution, but we're not going to be able to ultimately adopt it because we think it's too risky for the organization. If that's the case, you're going to have an awfully tough time getting people to serve in the future on those kinds of groups. And so what you might want to consider is, if, in order to deal with this issue of risky shift, if you are going to assign a group within an organization to do a particular task, you may want to give them parameters. You may want to give them an outline of how much money they can spend or how many organizational resources can they capture. You may have to give them some idea of the percentage of the problem that must be solved as a result of their particular proposed solution. If you give a group parameters, then they can't go beyond and they can't pick up solutions that are far too risky for an organization. Again, this is responsible use of small groups for decision making. If you know that risky shift is out there, and if you think the decision that might be agreed upon by a group is too difficult for your organization to accept, then it's your job as the leader going into that particular situation to tell the people in that group, here are the boundaries, here are the limits of what you can do. At this point, I want to look at the next slide. It talks about definitions of small groups. And again, there's no magic here. It may seem obvious. Gout and Perigo define a small group of collections of three or more individuals who interact with one another in order to achieve a common task or goal. Note there that you have to have at least three, because just two people working together is a dyad. When you introduce that third person, you introduce an infinitely more complex set of communications because of the fact that there are three people who are working together. The questions that come up when you look at that kind of definition, though, are, when is a group too big to be a small group, and must the interaction be face-to-face? Well, let's deal with the first question first. When is the group too big? Well, your book seems to say that things start to degrade when it gets upwards of 20 people in a small group. Frankly, I think you'll be able to see evidence of degradation far earlier than that. And I would begin to feel uncomfortable when small groups get bigger than, say, about 9 people. After that, I think you risk some of the problems that I talked about with the problems related to when groups get too big. The second question, must the interaction be face-to-face? Again, I would agree with your book in this case. Adler spent some time talking about virtual teams. That's really interesting research to look over, and I think as the technology revolution continues, we're going to find more and more work where the folks don't actually have to be face-to-face. In fact, if you look closely at the Adler chapter 8 on this particular area, they talk about 4 key elements for group communication that you have to consider in whether or not you're working in small groups. It has to do with size, that is the size, the number of people working together, whether or not they have a chance to interact, so interaction is second. They have to have some kind of shared purpose or goal. And finally, they have to be interdependent. That is, their success depends on the other people in that group. I think when you've got those 4 key elements working, you probably do have small group communication working, and that the things that we're talking about in this lecture today apply. If you go to the next slide, I talk about a little bit about typologies of groups in organizations. Once you start to use groups in communication, once you start to use teams in organizations, you begin to say, well, you know, these are different kinds of teams. There are different purposes that teams or groups may have. Does that make a difference? Well, in fact, let me first say that if you look at the long history of literature related to small group communication in my field, I think what you'll find is that the vast majority of the small group communication research that's been done over the years has actually been done involving problem-solving groups. Now, that's not surprising, right? Because if there was early research that was sponsored by business and industry, and there was in the 1950s, a fair amount of research, particularly at the University of Michigan, where small group communication was studied, business has problems to solve. And they wanted to find better ways of solving those problems. And so lots and lots of the original research that was done on small group communication was done using problem-solving groups. But those are, of course, not the only kind of groups we see in a business. This particular typology is called a functional typology because it divides groups up based on their various functions. The first bullet you see there is learning groups. That is, sometimes we bring people together to get them to give them a chance to learn more about what's going on in the organization. So, for instance, it might be that you have a group of software engineers that meet on a weekly basis over lunch. They have a brown bag where they come in and talk to one another about how a particular proprietary software that your company uses works and how to make it better and how to learn how to use it more effectively. That group is convened not because they're friends, not because they're solving a problem, but merely because they're trying to learn more about what it is they're doing. Okay, so that would be a learning group. Self-maintenance groups. This is an interesting and really easy example of this. About every couple of weeks, the provost, Joe Sheely at the university, puts together what he calls his Dean's Council. And his Dean's Council consists of all the deans of the various colleges at the university. And so the Dean of the College of Arts and Letters, the Dean of the College of Education, the Dean of the College of Business Administration, all to get together. And one of the important functions of that group is self-maintenance, of getting to know how other parts of the organization are dealing with problems. How are they, for instance, dealing with the shortage of large classrooms on campus? How are they dealing with budget shortfalls? Have they solved something? So that if one group comes up with a way of solving a problem, that might be shared with the other members of the group, just so that you essentially have the right hand knowing what the left hand is doing in these kind of situations. Self-maintenance groups can be a very important part of any regular small group function in an organization, because especially when organizations get large and complex, making sure that information is traveling horizontally in an organization well is what you can accomplish in a self-maintenance group. As I said before, problem-solving groups are the ones that were most often the object of research in academia in the 50s and 60s when small group communication was born as a discipline. And probably to this day, problem-solving groups are still at the heart of what people in business use small groups for. They want to use the creativity and productivity of a small group to try and figure out how to solve a problem. So that's pretty obvious. The final one here may be one that's not quite as obvious, and it's probably a more recent development in the business landscape and one that we're just recently kind of appreciating, and that is that there are times when, in the course of the life of a business, you're going to need to use therapeutic groups, that is, groups that are used somehow to help heal problems that people in that organization might have. Some of the classic kinds of therapeutic groups that you might actually see that meet in businesses are AA groups, Alcoholics Anonymous. These people come together to kind of deal with their problem, their addiction to alcohol, and ways to maintain and make sure that they're living one day at a time as sober individuals. You may have groups that come together to deal with the common problem in a large organization of folks who, for instance, are taking care of adult parents, whether because they have dementia, whether because they have no place else to live, they're now living with you, and what you're trying to figure out is how to balance the needs of your family with this older generation who is now living with you. And so companies might sponsor support groups where people get together and kind of talk about these things. In fact, the whole area that I'm talking about has been classified by HR, by human resource groups, as employee assistance programs. And more companies are finding out that employee assistance programs are a very important part of their process. They've seen that it's not only the right thing to do to help their employees solve problems, because if you help your employees solve problems, you're not going to have as much absenteeism. You're not going to have people leaving, so that you won't have as much turnover. Really, though we'd like to think that businesses make decisions because it's the right thing to do, in this case, when we're talking about therapeutic groups and the use of employee assistance programs, there's some research that I'm aware of that suggests for every dollar you invest in employee assistance programs, you get back 16 on the bottom line. So a 16-to-1 kind of return for investing in employee assistance programs, I think, makes a lot of business sense, as well as kind of being kind of the right thing to do to give your people the tools that they need to solve problems in their lives. And so you might find that these therapeutic groups meet in organizations. Of course, functional typologies are not the only way to talk about different kinds of groups. And our friend Peter Drucker, this is a fellow who's been a great business thinker for a very long time, written a number of books, probably well over 90 at this point. I believe he just passed away not too long ago. But Drucker has a very interesting approach to dealing with teams and groups, and I'd like you to consider what he says are three kinds of teams that businesses might use. He calls the first kind of team work teams. That is, where you have people who are doing very specific jobs. There's not a lot of interaction between them, but they get together and everybody has a job to do and that person does it. And he argues that there's a metaphor going on here of sports through all of these, that a work team is much like a baseball team where you have very specialized roles where, for instance, in baseball, you have, you know, left-handed pitchers and right-handed pitchers. You have outfielders, you have infielders, you have catchers. Everybody has a specific role. And in some cases, you even specialize within the position that a player plays so that, for instance, you don't just have pitchers, but you have left-handed pitchers and right-handed pitchers. And you have pitchers who start games, and you have pitchers who are closers, and you have middle relievers. And so everybody has a very specialized function. And he says that even if you, as you examine the language of baseball teams, on baseball teams, people talk about being on a team, not in a team. Okay, that we talk about being on a baseball team, not in a baseball team. And for Drucker, that was significant because it talks about the way in which there is interaction and cohesiveness among the team, and that, in fact, that people can work pretty independently and not have to interact quite as much. A second kind of team that Drucker found, he called them cross-functional teams. And again, he sustained the sporting metaphor here and said that this is kind of like a football team, that on a cross-functional team, people have their primary responsibilities, that day-to-day they do the things in their job that they need to do. But when the situations change, when there's an important contingency, they may have to be able to change and develop and do another kind of job. If you think about a football team, for instance, you have, you know, offense, you have players that, you know, play offense and defense. But as the game flows along, depending on what happens in the game, there may be an immediate shift in what happens. So, for instance, somebody who plays wide receiver, who thinks that their job is only to catch the ball when it's thrown to them or perhaps block a little on a running play, you know, if there's an interception, all of a sudden that wide receiver can't sit down and say, well, I'm sorry, I'm just a wide receiver and I don't play defense. When the game changes because there's a fumble or because there's an interception, that wide receiver's job now is to tackle the person with the ball. It's their job to switch from what they were doing to what needs to be done at the moment. Cross-functional teams are one in which people are trained for their specific job, but they are also cross-trained for other jobs so that when there is an emergency, when there is a change of circumstance, when situations are altered, they're able to step in and do the job of the team that needs to be done at the time. A final kind of team that Drucker suggests he calls a self-managed team. And he argues that this is very much like a doubles team in tennis, essentially. There are no leaders on a doubles team. There are simply two people working together. And they are fully interchangeable. So think about the way in which a doubles team in tennis works, right? Both people have to serve the ball. They have to serve. Both people have to receive serve. Both people need to be able to play the net. Both people need to be able to make good ground strokes. A good doubles team in tennis works together, and they are completely interchangeable. For instance, and the other thing is that they don't have an outside leader who directs what they do. So even though when, you know, Serena Williams and Venus, her sister, get together and play on a doubles team, as much as Richard, their dad, would like to be the one directing them on what to do during the match, the truth is that Venus and Serena work this out on their own. They're completely interchangeable, and they manage themselves. Same thing might be true on a beach volleyball team, right, where people are working together and they have no external management. These people are fully interchangeable. Everybody's got to serve. Everybody's got to dig. Everybody has to learn to spike at the net. Good self-managed teams in a business have fully interchangeable roles where they can, at a moment's notice, step in across the spectrum for whatever's needed, so that if part of the team goes down, somebody else can fill in. If circumstances require that everybody switch to a particular role in that circumstance, then they can do that because they have the training. Now, in Drucker's typology, remember that depending on the kind of teams that you're going to have, whether they're work teams or cross-functional teams or self-managed teams, they put a particular burden on the organization to provide the training that's necessary to make sure that they get things done. And so you're going to have to invest a little bit in training to make sure that people are cross-trained so that they're doing more than their own job. I want to talk briefly about some principles of small group leadership. Some of these are talked about in Chapter 8, but here's a couple that I want to kind of extract and mention particularly. One of the first principles I want to talk about is that leadership is not always vested in the formal leader of the group. That is, what we're talking about here is leadership is a role that gets enacted. It is not necessarily just a position. In my own department, for instance, though I am the chair of the department, I know that there's a substantial leadership role that's played by my administrative assistant. She's been here for 30 years. She knows how to do everything. She knows how to keep track of problems, and she knows how to solve issues. Even though I am the head of the department, and though I am the chair of the department, it's also true that she leads by her knowledge in the group. She exercises a particular kind of power, as the Adler text points out in Chapter 8, that is akin to expertise or expert power, and she exercises that power because she's been here for over 30 years and knows how to take care of problems. So as you talk about leadership of small groups, remember that it's not always the leader of the group on paper who becomes the leader of the group in fact. One of the very interesting findings of the research that was done in the 50s and 60s at the University of Michigan on leadership, they looked very closely at how people become leaders and what kind of styles of leadership they enact. And one of the interesting things that they found is that leadership is not a single thing. That in fact leadership was what they called multidimensional. And two dimensions they found were most important. One was called task orientation. Okay? And people's task orientation was this notion that there's work to be done on the committee, and that a good leader has to pay attention to that, and a good leader has to be the person who moves the agenda forward, who gets the reports filed on time, who makes sure that the next meeting gets scheduled. That's task orientation, pressing forward the work of the group. That, however, is not, that may be the traditional notion of leadership in a group, but it's not the only kind of leadership that gets taken care of by a good leader in a group situation. The second kind of leadership that they saw at this University of Michigan research was called socio-emotional leadership, or having a socio-emotional orientation. And the notion here is that sometimes what's important for groups is not pressing the work forward, but making sure that the people in the group feel satisfied, make sure that the people in the group have the tools that they need to do the research or to do the work that they're doing, that they're a cohesive group, that they work well together. And sometimes that means that there has to be leadership based on how people are getting along rather than simply what they're doing. And that's socio-emotional leadership. And the interesting thing that they found was that it was not very often that they found a leader in a small group who could exercise effectively both kinds of these two dimensions. That is, it was very unlikely to find a task-oriented leader who was also a good socio-emotional leader. And so what they often found that was with groups that existed over a fairly long period of time, that the leader of the group would exercise a particular kind of leadership, whether it was task or socio-emotional, and then a lieutenant, a second in command, would emerge that would exercise the complementary kind of leadership. So if the leader of the group was a good task-oriented leader, it might be that a lieutenant would emerge who would kind of be the team mom, who would be the person who was concerned with cracking a joke when it got too heavy, making sure that people had coffee and donuts when they got into the meeting in the morning, that this kind of socio-emotional leadership, where people were worried about how people felt and whether or not they were satisfied with what was going on in the group, was a very important, in fact, equally important kind of leadership, but it was not the same as task leadership, and it was not often the situation where a person could do both successfully. So you need to think about leadership as maybe coming from different people in a small group. A final note on just general principles of small group leadership is the notion that leadership cannot always be compelled. And your book spends some time talking about the notion of emergent leadership, that is where, you know, leaders are not chosen, but in fact they emerge from a small group. And I would think I would make the argument that because of this difficulty of some people feeling not very comfortable with small group leadership, that you want to give small groups, if you can, a chance to choose or develop their own leaders. That the leaders that come out and emerge from group process are probably going to be superior to a situation where you simply appoint somebody as the leader of a small group. Because that's an important process for a group to go through, to figure out what kind of leadership they're most comfortable with, to find out what kind of leadership is most suited to the task that they are doing. And that ultimately, because some people just never quite feel comfortable with this mantle of leadership, it's important to give these small groups a chance to figure out for themselves who their leaders are. And that's the discussion in Adler about emergent leadership. Okay. I want to take a look at three different styles of small group leadership and the situations under which they're most appropriate, because this may be some of the key findings that came out of the University of Michigan in the 1950s and 1960s. I'm going to talk about style of leadership, I'll talk about their advantages and disadvantages, and the kind of communication behaviors that are likely to show up in groups led by this particular leader. And I think the point I'm going to try and make with all of this stuff is that there is no single style of leadership that is always correct. I am not going to sit here or talk to you on this tape, on this MP3, and tell you that a certain kind of leadership is always successful or a certain kind of leadership is always needed in a particular kind of situation. I think if we think more about you folks developing a repertoire of skills, that you be able to conduct yourself in a way or lead a team in a particular way, depending on the situation that you've got, depending on the kind of problem that you're solving, depending on the kind of people that you have in the group. All of that can make a big impact on the style of leadership that's most appropriate. The three styles of leadership, just so we know what we're talking about here, are autocratic leadership, okay, or top-down leadership, democratic leadership, right? We have democratically elected folks. Or the final one is called laissez-faire. That's laissez-faire. It's a French term that means kind of let it be. And laissez-faire leaders are generally seen as people who are simply enablers. They are there. Their responsibility is to be there to help the group do its job, but they're not giving a lot of direction. They're simply there as facilitators for small groups. Let me go back and talk about autocratic leadership first. Because though it might seem like autocratic leadership is never appropriate, there frankly are times when autocratic leadership works. Even though it may seem like autocracy or authoritarianism is foreign to our culture, we don't really generally respond to leaders that are very authoritarian. We look obviously more towards democratic leaders. I got to tell you, you know, there are times and there are certain situations where I want an autocratic leader, because an autocratic leader can provide certain advantages that democratic leadership or laissez-faire leadership can't provide. I'll give you an example. There I am, passed out next to my car, in the parking lot with a heart attack. The ambulance crew rolls up. Three people get out of the ambulance. One of them has to decide to, you know, be the one to attach the defibrillator and give me the shock that's going to get me back into a kind of living and breathing situation. At that point, I don't want these people to start to argue about who gets to play with the defibrillator. I don't want them to decide by rock, paper, scissors who gets to be the one to call in the call or who's the one to assess my other vital signs. I want there to be clear direction from a singular leader in the group. I don't want to hear squabbles about who got to run the defibrillator last time. This seems pretty reasonable to me, I think, that in this case, authoritarian leadership is appropriate. One person tells the other two what to do, and that's going to be best for me, having a heart attack, laying on the sidewalk or laying on the pavement in a parking lot at Sac State. So, what are the advantages for authoritarian leadership? And there are some. Obviously, in situations where time is of the essence, authoritarian leadership can be best, right? If something has to happen quickly, if you need a decision right away, sometimes authoritarian leadership gets you there more quickly. It's more efficient. Not only does it happen more quickly, but it happens more efficiently. Larger groups are often run better by more authoritarian leadership. And then finally, if the task is relatively simple, authoritarian leadership can be the best way to kind of move a large group of people to that particular end. Now, of course, the disadvantage to authoritarian leadership is it comes at the cost of cohesion. Your book talks pretty extensively about cohesiveness, about this notion of people feeling like they're a member of a team. And that's exactly what suffers when we talk about authoritarian leadership. Because the direction is coming from the top, because the authoritarian leader is not giving people a chance to participate, because the authoritarian leader is making many of the decisions by herself or himself, it means that people are not going to feel very much a part of the group. And if that's why you have the group there in the first place, if you want people to feel like they're part of a group, if you really desire people's input, then authoritarian leadership is not really the best thing at this point in time. Communication studies researchers have looked at what communication behaviors look like in groups that are run by authoritarian leaders. And as you could imagine, much of the communication that happens in the group is dominated by the leader. It either flows from or is directed to the leader of the group because the authoritarian leader doesn't need the consent of the members to do the job that's being done. The leaders tend to control the discussion. There tends to be low feedback from other people. There tends to be low involvement from other people. They don't really feel like they're part of the process because, you know what? They're really not a part of the process. What we have here is a situation where a single person is dominating the group and they're using the resources of the group to advance their interests or the interests of that particular group, but it's not a particularly high priority about how the process in which this decision is made. So that's autocratic leadership. Obviously, there are many times when you would not want autocratic leadership, but frankly, when I'm lying on the pavement in the parking lot having my heart attack, I would think autocratic leadership would be just fine for my ambulance crew. Thank you very much. A second one that we talked about a little bit is democratic leadership. And you would think, oh, democracy. This would be perfectly consonant with our culture. It would always be the correct kind of leadership in every particular case. And I want to argue that that's not, in fact, the situation, that there are times when democratic leadership, of course, is exactly what you want. If you're trying to gain people's assent and commitment to implementing a difficult organizational change, I think democratic leadership is important here because you want people to feel like they're members of the group and that their participation had a big impact on the way in which the group ultimately worked. The advantage of democratic leadership in groups is that you get very high levels or reported levels of satisfaction with the way the group is running because they have a part in it. You have high levels of commitment to the group purpose, again, because they feel like they're involved. And frankly, democratic leadership is very important when you're dealing with tasks that are very complicated, when you have a tough problem to solve, you need the resources of all of the members of that group. You can't afford to have an authoritarian leader make a decision in this case, because one of the reasons you got together the different people in this group is because they have different expertise from different parts of your organization. The only way to make sure that that expertise is fully integrated into a decision of a small group is to make sure that you have a leadership style where those people can participate and be heard. So it's really important for you to understand as a democratic leader that it's your job to involve all the other members, and that those people will feel more satisfied, and particularly when you're working on complicated tasks, that's exactly the kind of leadership you want to have. Now, of course, there is a downside to democracy, and that downside is that democracy, as you might guess if you look at our Congress, if you look at our state legislature, democracy can be terribly inefficient. It takes time. As long as you have important processes that need to be followed, you're going to have delays. The bill has to go through three different readings, and there has to be committee hearings, and there has to be a chance to debate, and there has to be a chance to make amendments. So making policy can be very inefficient. If you compare making policy or the way in which governments run under authoritarian leaders and under democratic leaders, you'll find that in general, authoritarian leaders may be efficient. People may not like them very much, but, as they used to say during Mussolini's rule during of Italy, that you may not care much for Mussolini, but at least the trains ran on time. And the reason the trains ran on time is that if the trains ran late, Mussolini would have the conductors executed. Now, that doesn't sound very democratic, and in fact, it isn't. But if your priority is getting the trains to run on time, then maybe authoritarian leadership is okay. But in many, many other situations, you're going to have to deal with the notion that it's going to take longer to make democratic decisions, because you have to give people a chance to participate and a chance to kind of become involved in the way in which those decisions are made. Okay. What kind of communication behaviors are most obvious in groups that are led by democratic leaders? Well, what you see is a high rate of people mediating conflicts, of trying to balance different points of view. You have a lot of paraphrasing, where people say, what I hear you saying is that you want this, this, and this, and what I'm trying to tell you is that in order for that to happen, I have to have this, this, and this. Mediating conflicts happen more in democratically led groups. Good leadership in these kind of groups is often in the form of encouraging participation, of getting people who have not been as forthcoming, who have not offered their views, to be in there slugging, to be in there talking about those issues. And it may require you to ask some people to step back a little bit to make some space for those people who have not yet participated fully. We also find that if you look at communication behaviors in democratically led groups, there's more time for socio-emotional orientation. Whereas in an autocratically led group, you may find that the task is the overwhelming issue. In a democratically led group, while task is still important, process is an important part as well. And process may mean making sure the people feel good about what they're doing, making sure people in the group feel like they're participating well, and the result will be a kind of far better situation, at least in terms of the socio-emotional orientation of the group. The kind of leadership that emerged also from these studies, and one that you may be least familiar with, is called laissez-faire leadership. Laissez-faire leadership has also been called in some texts reluctant leadership, and it's also been pointed to as a negative kind of leadership. But again, I would argue that there are situations and there are contingencies when laissez-faire leadership is exactly the one that you want to adopt. Let me give you a brief example. When I was just an assistant professor here at Sac State, I was elected to a committee whose job it was going to be was to take all of the programs in the old arts and sciences, so something like 35 or 36 different majors, and we were going to rank order them in anticipation of some very severe budget cuts. And so our job essentially was to line people up and rank their programs as to whether or not they would be vulnerable for budget cuts. And that was kind of a scary thing when you started to think about it. And about the last place an untenured assistant professor ought to be. Well, I don't exactly know how this happened. This was back in the early 1990s, and I don't quite remember all the possibilities here. But all I know is that that one particular meeting, I found myself being elected the chair of this group. Now, mind you, everybody else on this particular group was tenured. Everybody else was far more my senior. They had more seniority than I did. In some cases, they were department chairs. In some cases, they were people who had been here for 25 or 30 years. They knew way more about the university than I did. But here I was, kind of being the leader of the group. And I recognized immediately that this is the time when laissez-faire leadership is really important, because what laissez-faire leadership takes advantage of is it utilizes the unique talents of your group. The leader becomes not so much one setting direction or setting tone, but really simply facilitating the group's process and kind of getting out of the way. A leader who uses laissez-faire leadership in these kind of situations says, you know what, I've got smart people in this group, we have a problem, we have work to be done, these people can work without a lot of direction from me, and what I really need to do is take a step back. In my case, it was a really important thing to do also because of the power differential in this particular group. Here I was, an untenured assistant professor. It would have been foolish for me to think that I could sit around this table with, you know, 10 other folks and tell them what to do. They were far more my senior. They had way more knowledge than I did about the situation. And so a laissez-faire leader is the person who kind of enables everybody else to do the work that needs to be done. You become a facilitator. Of course, the disadvantage to this kind of leadership is that sometimes people can go off in the wrong direction. And there may be a moment where a laissez-faire leader needs to exert a little control to kind of get people back on track. But again, you use a very light hand in doing so. The communication behaviors for laissez-faire leaders, again, you may facilitate group activity, but you don't direct the discussion. It may be that there's relatively poor feedback within the group because, frankly, you're relying on the expertise of these individuals, and they may not need to interact quite as much as you might find in a democratic group. Let me say one final thing about laissez-faire leadership, and that's that if you look at some textbooks, and in fact, we used to use one for this class, when they were particularly talking about the way in which women run groups. And we, in fact, had a textbook that suggested that the appropriate style of small group leadership for women running a small group meeting was to only use laissez-faire leadership, which I respond to and think about and say, what a load of sexist crap. I cannot believe that was even in print. And this is not too many years ago. To think that women need to only use one particular style of facilitative leadership, that they can't be democratic leaders, that they can't be autocratic leaders, is to be completely sexist and to suggest that somehow they have a smaller repertoire of leadership skills than males do. My suggestion is that both men and women have to learn about these different leadership styles. They have to think about what the conditions are that bring them to leadership and what the situation demands that they need to choose from that repertoire, what leadership style they're going to use. I think if you know a lot about each of these different styles of leadership, you're going to be in position to choose effectively from that palette and to choose the leadership style that's most important. The final thing I have for today has to do with types of small group decisions. And that is, if you're looking at particular small groups, how do they come to make a decision is also an important issue. Some are very much connected to the kind of leadership that the small group is using. In other cases, they're not. But let's talk about these briefly. One I've already mentioned before, and the first kind of decision-making that you often see in small groups is called consensus-making, or building a consensus. And as I noted before, consensus is not like everybody talking for a long time and then voting. Consensus means that people have worked out their differences and that they can all come to agree on a particular path, on a particular course of action, on a particular solution. That they've worked out their differences to a point where they can all agree. consensus building, which is great because you're getting everybody on the same track. And if you're trying to implement an organizational change, I think it would be really important to have that group come to an actual consensus on the organizational change, because then everybody is equally committed. Nobody can say later, oh, no, well, I voted against this. They're all in it together. But the problem is that consensus building becomes more difficult with the number of people that you have and the number of different interests that they represent. So as you get a bigger group or as you get a more diverse group, it may become far more difficult for you to get to the point where you can actually get a consensus. It takes a long time to build consensus. It takes a long time to work through the various problems and the various issues that you have in a group. And so you can't always come to a consensus. And you may have to have a backup plan that says, you know, after an hour of discussing this, we may have to come to some other way of coming to a decision. And one of those other ways is compromise. Compromise you see a fair amount in politics. It's a trading of options. It says, you know what, I'll give up this part of my solution if you'll give up that part of your solution, and then we can work together. Compromise suggests that each group that's working together towards a decision, or each member of a small group that's working towards a solution to a problem, needs to recognize that there is a larger interest that needs to be served, and it may be that the immediate interest that you are advocating needs to be subordinated, that you need to step back a little bit and say, the only way this is going to happen is if we do X or if we do Y. We don't see a lot of bipartisanship, frankly, at either the national or at the state level, although we've seen a little bit more at the state level because the governor's been willing to work across party lines. But when we talk about compromise, we're talking about a situation where, you know, though it sounds good for process, right, everybody worked together to get to a decision, you have to be careful because sometimes compromise, it doesn't come up with the best policy. Sometimes compromise doesn't get you to the point you need to be at. Sometimes it was important for somebody to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to compromise. We need to do it this way. And sometimes compromise is the worst of all worlds. It just happens to be the world that everybody could agree upon. So again, there are advantages to compromise. You get agreement, but the disadvantage may be that you may be not crafting the best policy overall. The third type of group, small group decision that you see on your PowerPoint there is simply voting, right? You discuss for a while and then everybody says, okay, let's vote. Well, you know, how could that ever be a bad thing? Well, let me tell you, there are some times when voting makes for dysfunctional decision making. If you have a small but identifiable minority of folks in your small group, and I'll give you an example in my own department. Some years ago, we subsumed the journalism folks in our department. So there are something like 30 comm studies people and like 6 journalism people in my department right now. Well, we could say that every decision that we make in the communication studies department is democratic, and that's important. But remember, if it's something that the journalism people really want and the comm studies people really won't, or really don't, we can vote all day long. And if that vote comes out 30-6, that's not going to be very satisfying for the 6 people who constantly find themselves in the minority and are not able to win people over to their side. Remember that any vote, once it's made public, and if it's not unanimous, is going to guarantee that there are people walking around in that group meeting with essentially, you know, L's on their forehead. They're going to be losers, because when you have a vote, you identify winners and you identify losers in a very stark and dramatic way. So there are times when certainly voting can be fair, when it's the best kind of decision making to make, but it also may be that voting ultimately is dangerous because it types a particular group within that small group as a loser. The last two kinds of decision making you see there are railroading, which if you think about it a little bit, you would know lines up pretty well with what happens with authoritarian kinds of leadership. Railroading means that the leader gets their way and forces their decision on the rest of the people. It obviously doesn't make for a very good cohesiveness in the group, but it's the kind of decision making that we often see with authoritarian or autocratically led groups. The final one there is called coalitions or hand clasping. Sometimes people recognize that even though they have very different individual interests, there are times when those interests coincide. So, for instance, in the early 1980s, there was a very interesting coalition of people that worked together in this country. They were interested in restricting access to pornography. And two people that you would not ever think of working together on a project, the late Jerry Falwell, who was head of the Moral Majority at the time, and the late Andrea Dworkin, who was a very passionate, radical feminist, who normally wouldn't have given Jerry Falwell the time of day, worked together on a particular initiative because they both had a reason for trying to restrict access to pornography. Those reasons were very different, but the outcome was the same. They say that politics makes strange bedfellows, and this is a case where certainly you would never have seen Falwell and Dworkin giving each other the time of day, but because they were both, for their own reasons, working towards restricting access to pornography, they formed a coalition. They moved across the aisle to work with one another. We tend to see coalitions working more in parliamentary democracies like Italy or Israel or the Great Britain. We don't see it quite as much in the United States where there are just two parties, but sometimes coalitions get built among conservative Democrats and moderate Republicans, for instance. It's a kind of small group decision making that you have to keep in mind in order to ultimately get work done. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're about at 75 minutes, and so I'm going to close for now. If you have any questions, of course, you can always contact me at nburnett@csus.edu. Initial questions, of course, should go to your lab leaders, but I'd be happy to chat if you have any issues or questions about this lecture. Again, this was Groups 1. Be sure and listen to this lecture and Groups 2 before you attempt to do the group special occasion speech. Thanks very much.